Alright, good morning. We'll be starting class momentarily, continuing with the theme of temple. And we'll start just about a minute or two. The answers for Daniel, did he agree with them?
I have not had a chance to review those with him, but that's on my list to do.
All right, great. Good questions.
Yeah, thank you for answering those. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. You got my response to your letter? You had sent something in with Cal this week, so I just wrote you back. Thank you.
Oh, yes, I did.
Right.
Thank you.
Appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cal. How you doing there?
Doing pretty good.
Good. So why don't we start off and see if there's any questions you have, or anything that we did, or anything that came up during the week. And good morning to Josh.
Hey.
I see Joshua online. Good morning, Josh.
I don't think so. I think I'm good in the question department for the moment.
Okay, that's good. All right, so being that we're in the midst of the whole discussion of the temple and the vessels, so I thought we'd discuss a little bit more in terms of I'm not sure if we took it up in class here or something that I had sent out, you know, in the articles, but we see, you know, the interesting thing about the temple is that it parallels a number of the events that the Jews had encountered. You know, and as we're going through it, you know, we saw, like, for example, the first Ramban, Nachmanides' commentary on the Torah portion of Truma discusses how the ark is gold, and it parallels the flames that were on top of Mount Sinai. And it talks about that, how that would be a perpetual duplication of that event. And he also hints that if you look carefully at the verses, so you know there's more. It seems to be saying that more of a parallel that you'll see. You take a look there in this commentary, the first commentary.
I'm sorry, Rabbi, is that Maimonides or Nachmanides?
Nachmanides.
Thank you.
Yeah, he says, let me just locate his exact words. Let's States. It says if you look, if you ponder carefully, how's the sound, by the way, all right?
Yes, it's excellent. Thank you.
Okay. So he says, if you ponder carefully at the verses that are stated by the giving of the Torah, and you understand what was written in them, you will also understand the fundamentals of the tabernacle and the temple. All right? And you'll be able to understand in it what was stated by King Solomon in his wisdom, when in his prayer that he enunciated upon his the erection of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Okay. So he doesn't really say that the rest of the temple is alluding to other things. He's saying that if you look at Mount Sinai, so then you'll understand the temple and the tabernacle. What I'm suggesting is that based on the fact that he's equating one event, which is Sinai, to the Holy of Holies, the Ark, and again, he equates the gold color of the flames to the gold color of the Ark, and the, of course, that's where the tablets were given, were from the midst of the fire, so the tablets are in the middle of the gold Ark. And also, if you think about it, the mountain itself was roped off. The Jews were not allowed to go up to the mountain because that was to prevent them from expressing any type of anthropomorphism in connection with God. Had they gone up to the mountain, so then they would have thought, or they would have been expressing that there is something more to be seen on God, in connection with God on the mountain than off the mountain. And that's heresy. God is not in the mountain. So the mountain was roped off. Similarly, the Holy of Holies, that room in the temple, is roped off by the Parochus curtain. And nobody was allowed in there except for the high priest on two different times during Yom Kippur. That was it. The rest of the year was off limits. So what I was saying is that you could, perhaps there's other equations. I mean, when the Jews first left Egypt, you saw that God created this cloud. That led them by way, and the pillar of fire that went with them by night to give them light. But the verse doesn't just say that he created this to give them directions to Mount Sinai as they were traveling from Egypt, but it says that God went with them, which is extra. That's not necessary to say if the clouds are merely to follow the cloud until you get to where it stops. And you see this is true because the Ramban actually states later on when Moses was pleading with God not to destroy the Jews by the sin of the spies. So he says that the other nations are going to say, because you have no ability to bring them into the land that you promised them, and therefore you killed them in the desert. That's what this is going to look like, God, if you destroy the Jews because of the sin of the spies. And he says, why will the other nations say this? Because they have an estimation that you, God, relate to the Jews like eye to eye, meaning a very close relationship. And that is seen with your cloud. So you see, Moses understands clearly that the nature of the cloud was not simply just to lead the Jews, but it was to show that there was a relationship between God and the Jews. And any time Moses went into the temple and God would speak to him, or the tabernacle, and God would speak to him. So you read in this week's portion, yesterday's portion, that the cloud descended, the pillar of cloud descended, and then God would speak with Moses. So the cloud was to indicate a relationship. And you see that you have that in the temple. As soon as you walk into the tabernacle, or the temple, you have the incense altar. That's the first thing that you're confronted with. And we always say that the concept of cloud is to demonstrate that there's cloud is something which obscures your vision. And it's a metaphor for the fact that we do not know anything about God, and that our vision, so to speak, in our mind of God is completely clouded. We cannot know what God is. We can know things about what he's done. We can study ideas that are true, but we can't know what he is. So that's what cloud is there. But it could also be that it's putting into the tabernacle. It's a fixing into the tabernacle, which is a perpetual structure that has to have fundamental ideas. So this is one of the fundamentals. So it seems it's picking up on that. You also have the manna that God fed the Jews. And that was something which you also see you have in temple. You have the showbread. So there's a number of ideas that are included in the temple that really are replica of events or ideas that God was teaching the Jews. It wasn't just a matter of feeding them. There was a whole nature to them. Why did he have to give miraculous food? And what was the concept of the Sabbath being built into the manna? So this is just a framework in terms of what we'll discuss, you know, this morning. But it is very interesting that you have a lot of this. I also noticed too that you have the candelabra, the menorah, so that you also had the pillar of fire that was part of the travels of the Jews, and you had the well of Miriam that went with the Jews to give them water, and you also have at the entrance of the temple you have the laver, which is the washing basin. It is very uncanny, and I didn't see any support for this. But it is uncanny that you have so many parallels of those events en route from Egypt to Sinai. And another interesting thing, which is the first thing I want to discuss, is the difference between the miracles. There is a distinction between miracles that took place between Egypt and getting to Sinai. And that distinction is that Moses was involved with some, and he was not involved with others. So the question is why, and let's try to list which ones are which. So I'll leave that to you now to see if you could suggest which ones Moses was involved in and which ones he wasn't. And good morning, Rosora. Good to see you too. Okay, so that's the opening question.
Well, he was involved in the one where he was supposed to speak to the rock, I think, but struck it and water came out.
Right, so there he was involved. God told him to either speak or to hit it on different occasions.
The miracle of Korach and his followers being swallowed up, Moses seemed to know about, but didn't have any active hand in.
Yeah, I wonder whether he knew, or it was something that his mind told him was true, meaning that when he told Korach that if you die a regular death, then God did not send me, because that was the whole dispute that Korach had, that he said that you're taking on too much. You've got you're the king, and your brother is the priest, right? Nepotism. There's a... this is not right. This is really not how the order should have been. I should have received a certain amount of greatness. So he was denying the prophecy of Moses, which is a grave sin. That's why he eventually died. But when Moses says that, but if the earth opens up and swallows you, if there's an unnatural way that you die, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows you, then you'll know that God sent me. Now, it could simply be like this, that Moses wasn't told. Moses was not told necessarily that this was going to happen. But how did he know? It could be, again, I mean, you think about Yosef in the dreams, you know, Joseph in the dreams. Does it say in the verses that God gave Joseph the answer of what the seven cows were and the 7 ears of corn? It doesn't say it there. It seems to be that Joseph had a very astute understanding of human psychology, and also he was able to detect when something was prophetic, and also look at the symbols to understand what they represent. So, the cows either being food or also being that which they plowed the ground with, and of course the ears of grain that he saw, the 7 ears, that certainly was food. So he knew that it was about food, and then he saw fat cows and he saw skinny cows. Emaciation, starvation. He was perhaps able to figure that out with his great understanding of dreams and also of how God works. perhaps Moses too. Now, what would be the way Moses would be able to determine that something unnatural had to happen right now by Korach? Forget about the fact that it was an earth opening up its mouth, but let's see if we could determine how Moses might have known this even without God telling him. Because the verses don't say that God gave him the prophecy at that point, does it? It just says that he responds to Korach and says that if you die a natural death, God didn't send me. But if the earth opens its mouth and swallows you, then you will know that God sent me. Now perhaps Moses knew this would have to happen. Why?
The only thing that comes to my mind is that because he knew that he was, if you will, in the right place doing what God wanted him to do, and here comes this guy who is challenging him, then it seems like he would have to know that God would step in to do something, except I'm not so sure that would be clear. I mean, he knows what he's supposed to do, and he knows he's following it. So here comes a guy who says, no, you're not. You've gone too far. You've violated, you know, kind of challenging him almost from a halakhic standpoint.
Yeah, he is.
And
right.
So, but just because somebody challenges you from a halakhic standpoint doesn't mean that God's going to necessarily intervene.
Right. I mean, there are many events where the Jews are complaining and Moses prays to God, or returns to God. He doesn't, make this type of a statement. We have to look for something specific in this case that might demand this type of response.
Well, Korach's trying to usurp his position, the sort of leadership position of the nation. But still, there's no guarantee that God will intervene.
Well, what was the nature of his complaint? What was the unique nature of this event that was incomparable to any other event?
Well, let's see. He's complaining that Moses has gone too far. He refused a direct command of Moses, which I think was to appear at a certain time. I'm forgetting my chronology. Does this happen after Aaron's two sons died because of unauthorized fire?
Yes.
Ah. Okay. So isn't... I wonder if Moses is certain then, because Korach's trying to step in and essentially do something halakhically that is outside the law.
Well, that's not what he's trying to do. He's just using that as an argument against Moses. He's trying to make fun of him. That was what was going on there. What's his primary complaint?
Well, his primary complaint is that Moses has too much power and he set himself up as a ruler that the people didn't agree to.
That he went against God, primarily. He's trying to say that he should have had this, and Moses is not following God.
Right. But... I'm just trying to find this section here.
After the spies in Numbers.
Uh, happen to remember the chapter number, do you?
Yeah.
It's, It's, 1629, numbers.
I'm sorry, say again?
1629 in numbers.
1629.
That's what Moses tells him if you die, you know, a different type of death. First, he tells him if you die naturally, then if you die unnaturally.
Well, I mean, okay, so Moses set up this challenge that, you know, tomorrow you'll, everybody comes and places fire on their fire pans and offers incense to it. He would, I think, have to have known that he knew he was chosen by Hashem to do that. So, given the experience that had already happened with Aaron's two sons, he would have to know that something bad was going to happen to Korach if he went and did a similar type of thing. Am I making sense?
Yeah, they take the fire pan, and so he's saying, say it again?
Well, so if the incident with Aaron's two sons has already occurred where they brought unauthorized fire and they died.
Right.
So now Moses knows if you do something like that in terms of the, you know, incense offerings or so forth with Hashem, it's not just going to be that nothing's going to happen. Something clearly will. So you have to stay within the halacha there. So what he sets it up is, okay, Korach, if you think that, you know, you're the chosen one, we'll stand before God tomorrow and we'll each bring fire and we'll see whom God chooses.
Right, but he's not telling them to do something that's going to be visited. He's saying this is how it will be decided, no?
Right.
He says that in the beginning, the very beginning of the parsha, and he says, yeah, he does a good political move. He says, Kulam Kedoshim. All the congregation is holy, in verse 16:3. And God is amongst everybody. And why do you raise yourselves higher? Why do you select it for yourself? And Moses heard this, and he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korach. And he says, in the morning, God will make known who are his selected priests. And he will draw close who he has chosen, right? And he says, this is how you do it. So he's not telling them to do something which is going to be inevitably visited with death. He says, this will be the method by which it will be determined.
Right, but here's my thought. If he's already seen that Aaron's two sons died when they offered incense that wasn't approved, wouldn't he be able to reason that if somebody else comes along and offers incense who is not appropriately empowered to do so, they will also die?
But he doesn't say at this point the statement that the earth is going to open up its mouth. That was after another event.
Oh, does he actually predict the method?
Yes. He ridicules them about wanting also the priesthood. They already had a certain amount of leadership. He says, is it a small thing that God separated you from the rest of the congregation to sacrifice? I mean, he was a Levite. So he already had a great status. And then you and your brothers come, and you also want to have the priesthood, which was not the Levites, but it was a certain Levites, which were Aaron's descendants. So he's ridiculing them for wanting to grab too much. Therefore, you and all of your congregation that have assembled against God, and Aaron, it's not us that you are complaining. So Moshe, what goes on next? What is it saying? He says later on in verse 17, he says, take your fire pans and put on them incense and bring them before God. 250 fire pans, you and also Aaron. So if it's going to cause death, it'll cause death to Aaron too then, according to what you're saying. So he's telling Aaron to do the same thing. Moses is telling Aaron to do the exact same activities, telling Korach and his 250 allies, his 250 cohorts.
But Aaron's authorized to bring incense, isn't he?
Well, if Moses is telling them to do it, it would seem to be that now this specific incense is a new thing.
Yeah, I see. Okay. And I also see in verse 30 that he does predict the earth swallow opening up. So, how could he know?
Okay, now Joshua is writing on screen that in 16:23 God does tell Moses something. So let's go down to there. 16:20. God says to Moses and to Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from the congregation, and I'll consume them in a moment. So Moses and Aaron both fell down on their face, and they prayed to God, and they said, God of all spirits, l'chol basar, right, of all flesh, if one man sins, and the entire congregation, you're going to be angry? So God spoke to Moses and said, speak to the congregation, saying, remove yourselves from around the encampment of Korach, Dathan, and Abiram. So Moshe got up. Right. And he tells the people to remove themselves from their tents. These wicked people, remove yourself from them. Don't touch anything of theirs, lest you be wiped away with them. And now, actually Josh is right. God does tell Moshe that he's going to wipe out everyone. He says, that's how Moshe understands it, that he's going to wipe out more than necessary. So Moshe says, no, just you don't take your anger out on others. So they're already, so Josh is right, there already is an indication from God that he's going to do something. Okay. And Moshe prays, and God responds. And he says, speak to the congregation that they remove themselves from the encampment of Korach, Dathan, and Abiram. So now Moshe is told, so it's my error. Moshe is told by God that something's going to happen. Alright, so my question falls away then. He was informed. The specifics not, but something was going to happen.
Did you have an answer though as to why, what made this different that Moses would have to know?
Yes. My thought was, and maybe it still might apply, is that since the very sin of Korach is saying that Moses is not following God, so what greater proof would there be to validate Moses that he is following God? If Moses predicts something miraculous and it takes place, like for example all the miracles in Egypt, the reason why there were the real unique quality of them was you could have swarms of locusts, you could have Burrard is an amazing thing, although my brother sent me an image that methane in a frozen state looks like snow, but it can burn. He showed me an actual image that was taken where there was like somebody was holding in their hands like a pile of frozen methane, and it was dripping as it was melting, and at the same time it was flaming, which could have been a possibility how Barad worked. So that means it worked within nature.
But it was the timing of the events that really showed Moses to be, you know, God's emissary. Because no one can predict when an infestation of lice or frogs or locusts or hail, things of that nature, without actually being informed by the Creator. So here, perhaps also, Bekorach, since the complaint was that Moses is not following God, so the way to demonstrate that he is that he makes a statement of something miraculous that can happen, and then it happens. So God following Moses' lead would show it would validate Moses, which is similar to what happened in Egypt. But again, like Josh pointed out, there is an indication that God told Moses that he's going to respond, and that they should the encampment is going to be wiped away. But that's a little bit of a tangent from what we were doing. Is there any other thought you had on this before we get back to temple?
My only thought about your approach would be, wouldn't that be a little bit risky for Moses to put out something and then expect God to follow through on it?
Unless he knew that this is the method of God. I mean, like Eliyahu, you know, Elijah, the yesterday's Haftarah, and he called out to God, and he said, "Answer me," and the fire came down from heaven and licked up the gallons and gallons of water and the wood and the sacrifice and even the stones. So was he told by God that this was happening? I don't know. But perhaps he knew that the only way to show the people that were following both God and also the idolatrous Baal was to have, this was a necessary demonstration. So perhaps his intelligence told him this he understood, perhaps without prophecy, he understood that something had to happen right now. And he responded. Perhaps Moses too. I don't know. I don't know if there, because it doesn't say that God told Elijah to go to the top of Mount Carmel and sacrifice when sacrifices were prohibited at that point. But the Torah's injunction is that you can temporarily suspend a Torah law for the sake of ensuring that the Torah continues. That's why they were able to write down the oral law at a certain point. It was prohibited to write down the oral law, but then the rabbi saw that it was being lost, and based on the injunction that Eis Las L'Hashem Hefer Torah Sefer, that there's a time we have to do something for God, not to benefit God, but for God's will, and we have to suspend the Torah law. So you're allowed to do that. But that's built into the system. Okay. All right, so getting back to the miracles, we see that there were two types of miracles. Miracles like, for example, in Egypt when Moses was involved and he lifted up a staff, and also by the splitting of the Yom Suf of the Red Sea, God tells him to stretch out his hand, and by the rock. But you don't see that by the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. God does those independent of Moses. You also do not see that in connection with the manna. So I'm wondering if we could see some sort of a reasoning for the this distinction. And what I found was also very interesting is that those three things, the fire and the cloud and the manna, those are the exact three elements that you have in the first room of the temple. The pillar of cloud by the incense, the fire is the candelabra, and the manna is the table with the showbread. And those are the very three events in which God does not have Moses do anything to bring those miracles about. Interesting, huh?
That is interesting.
But I think if we understand what temple is, we will be able to answer this. But think about the distinction for a moment.
you have the ones that Moses was involved in are a very specific point in time for a very specific purpose in that location. Whereas the fire, the cloud, and the manna, that's not very clear.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Were you wanting us to make a distinction between the fire and the cloud from the manna?
No, those are together.
Okay.
The question is, I guess the more basic question is just, can we give a reason why certain miracles would have Moses involved in them and certain wouldn't? And perhaps we can even broaden the statement to just the concept in general of God having a prophet who, this whole concept of a prophet in general. The institution of a prophecy and a prophet. And he's involved in upholding God's word and delivering God's word. It may be part of this whole question. But it seems to me that we have to look for the answer in terms of why would God want man to be involved, when we see that in certain cases he didn't have man involved, meaning Moses or the prophet. So what I would suggest is as follows. That I just want another moment to think.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, take a few more moments. Think about it.
I mean, the fire, the cloud, and the manna seem to have to do with leading the people and nurturing the people, providing for their needs. But then so does the water. They needed that. Splitting the Red Sea is kind of a one-time thing to save them from the Egyptians. The water coming out of the rock was a one-time thing for that place. The fire, the cloud, and the manna were, a constant indicator, I guess, of...
Well, the rock also. The rock went with them in the desert those 40 years.
I'm sorry?
The rock was not a one-time thing.
When Moses struck the rock and water came out of it?
Yeah, well, that's how they got water in the desert all those years was through the rock. It wasn't just a one time. There were only maybe one or two events where it talks about significant episodes in connection with the rock. But that doesn't mean that the rock didn't go with them all the time. That's where they get the water from.
I thought they got that from the well of Miriam.
Yeah, that was this. That's what we're talking about, the same thing. I believe the rock they refer to is the Well of Miriam.
So when Moses was told to go speak to the rock and he struck it at Meribah, that rock then traveled with them everywhere?
That's my understanding, unless I'm mistaken.
Wow, that's new information for me.
Well, they traveled to many, many places in the desert over 40 years. Where did they get water from? Whatever it was, there was something which went with them, which was miraculous.
Well, I realize this is an aside, but we're talking about 2 million people plus.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say we have a single well that somehow miraculously travels with us.
I'm not sure how the distribution works.
Yeah, you see where I'm going.
Yes. The manna, it rained down from the sky.
Right.
It actually came down from the sky, which itself was an amazing thing.
Does anyone suggest that the manna had enough moisture in it that they therefore didn't need additional water?
No, it does say it melted, though.
Yeah. I suppose, have a food that had enough water in it, although that seems unlikely in the desert country there. That's pretty hot and dry.
Well, I think the distinction we might be able to make is that the temple and the tabernacle itself are the objective is to give ideas about God. And when we're studying God, man can't be part of the focus. So in terms of the clouds that went by them, which showed God's relationship, we said that earlier, that the cloud really was to indicate there was a relationship between God and the people, and the same thing with the fire. And the man also, that God can sustain them, these are all ideas about God per se. So inasmuch as there are ideas about God, man is not involved. The focus has to be exclusively God. So Moses is not commanded to do anything, to initiate the miracle. It's not dependent upon man. My thinking was, though, in the other cases, like by Egypt, or by the splitting of the sea, when God tells Moses to, they needed water, and they cried for water, and God has Moses involved in all these miracles, perhaps God has Moses involved for the objective of a model of how you should respond in these situations. I mean, the Egyptians were living an improper life, so therefore, somebody who is wise, a prophet, that's what the prophet's role is. He demonstrates that it's only through a life of wisdom that you have this greater relationship with God, even to the point where you can be involved in miracles. And this was to educate them away from their wrong ideas, but the point was is that they, as human beings, were flawed. So therefore, a model of the right type of human being would be a good idea. So therefore, Moses can be involved. Same thing in terms of the Jews crying out by the splitting of the sea. So God says to Moses, this is not the time to cry. Meaning to say that the salvation is already at hand. There's no need for prayer at this moment. The reason why you're here at the Red Sea is precisely to drown the Egyptians. So Moses, again, is to display to the Jews that were terrified that there's no reason to be terrified. You think that God took you out with all these plagues and saved you in order that you should be now killed at the shores of the Red Sea? No. And also asking for water as well. God didn't take you into the desert in order to dry you and to parch you to death. So, again, I'm saying this as a suggestion, because we do see a difference between miracles that God is involved in himself and miracles where he brings Moses into the picture. And that could be that he brings in man in order that he is, not that God needs man at all, of course God needs nothing to accomplish his miracles. But if he brings man into the picture, it could be because it's necessary for there to be a role model. So when we're talking about ideas that God wants to impart to us about him, that there's a relationship that he has with us, that he has the ability to sustain us, so that is something which is not requiring any action on our part. So we don't need a role model of how we have to act, because this is not an idea, this is not a lesson about action, it's a lesson about thought, meaning concepts of God. So when we're dealing with that area, that realm of knowledge, so then action is not necessary. God is just trying to impart, he's trying to imbue us with new truths about him, that there's a relationship. But it's obscured, it's a cloud. It teaches us that idea as well, that we can't know what he is. That's what cloud indicates. But nonetheless, there is a relationship. And that he has the ability to sustain. That's what the man is all about. And the reason why he has the ability to sustain us is because he is the creator.
So that's why within the mon itself, there was a law not to gather it on Saturday. Shabbos became an integral part of the laws of mon. And, for example, you don't have a... We know that you can't... on Shabbos, for example, you can't pick an esrog, a citron off the tree to use for your lulav on the holiday of Sukkot. But there's no law in those laws of esrog and the lulav that say don't pick lulavs or esrogs off the tree on the Sabbath. We know that from the general concepts of the Sabbath, that uprooting and any type of farming is prohibited. So we take the general rule of Sabbath and we could apply it here. So you might think the same thing by the month. We have the general rules of Sabbath. You can't carry. So why do you have to tell me not to collect the mon as part of the integral laws of mon? It seems to be superfluous. See, on that level, you're right, it is. But unless, like we're saying, that the mon itself was to help the Jews realize that their sustenance comes straight from God and they should be relying completely on Him. Therefore, teaching them the concept that He's creator and building into the laws of the mon a prohibition to collect on Saturday. And God also made a miracle that what they collected Friday for that day's amount miraculously doubled when they brought it back to their tent. So it lasted them for Saturday too. Is to teach, because once I now see that God's creator, that is the most fundamental principle that allows me to accept that He will provide for me in the future, because He's controlling the whole world. He's the creator. Right, you see the idea?
I think so.
I'll say it again. The question is, why does mon have to have a law not to collect it on the Sabbath? We have the general principle about Sabbath that you don't collect. You don't carry. But it was to teach you that part of the lessons of the mon was to turn the people's mindset towards God and view Him as creator. So by not collecting the mon on Saturday reminded us of God as creator. And that concept of Him as creator then would help fortify our reliance in Him. Because if He's the creator, so of course He can provide. He's controlling the entire world. So God builds into the mon that concept. But that's again for the sake of understanding God. So all these ideas about the mon and the cloud of God's relationship with us, those are all to impart ideas to us. It's not requiring any action. It's not a law that governs how we must act. So therefore there's no model needed. There's no man that has to be part of the miracle to demonstrate the right way to do it. It has nothing to do with action. It has to do purely with the world of the conceptual, meaning concepts of God. It's only when it comes to our actions that God now brings man into the miracle to have a role model. This is how you must act. Oh, so let me bring man. Let me bring Moses into this, and he'll get involved in the miracle. Now it sets up a role model in terms of our actions. So when it has to do, when the lesson has to do with how we must act, so God brings a person into the picture. That's a role model. But when the miracle that God is doing is to teach us ideas, so that has nothing to do with actions. Ideas are purely in our minds. So there's no need to have a person involved.
Okay.
And therefore, those three are in temple, meaning the manna is the showbread, and the pillar of cloud is the incense altar that makes the cloud. And the pillar of fire, you have fire represented by the candelabra. And you see, very interesting also, that the candelabra, the menorah, is directly against the table with the showbread. It parallels it in terms of its position. Why? Could be because since the candelabra has seven branches to indicate the God who rested on the seventh day, creation, the lesson of creation, so therefore creation is something which is now paralleling the manna. It's now part of what we see together. And when we look at it, we see the table is right next to the menorah. The menorah is right up against where the table is. The same exact, it parallels it physically. It's spatially against it. Because there's a relationship of the Sabbath with the manna. But But all the ideas in the temple and the holiest, this room, those three, those were the three miracles that man was not involved in, that Moses was not involved in. Because these were ideas that God's imparting to us about him, not about our actions, but about our concept of God. So it's interesting how those three miracles that Moses was not involved in, those have parallels in the holiest. Because those are ideas that since the temple is all about God, nothing about man, so those specifically God did not ask Moses to be involved in. Observations. I don't have any substantiation in terms of any other, like, the Rambam or the Ramban or Rashi, just observations that I saw that they wanted to share. And I could be wrong, but it is an interesting thing if it's true.
Rabbi, when we talk about these ideas, or these things are there to give us ideas about God, are we talking about ideas about God or ideas about how God relates to the world? In other words, are they telling us something about him, or are we still in the realm of how he relates to the world?
I would say the latter, because to know anything about him, we can't know.
Okay. I thought that was the case, but I just wanted to confirm that.
Right. That's a good distinction you made. You see the 13 attributes of Moses that God imparted to Moses. I believe we just read this yesterday, yeah. That they're, like you said, they are attributes of how he relates to man. What he is, we don't know. That's also in yesterday's Parsha. What God is, we can't know. Moses wants to know God's glory. God says, man can't know me while he's alive. All right. Any questions or comments?
No, I think we're good here, but thank you. That was a very interesting idea.
Yeah. Be nice to get some support for it, so if you see anything on it, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a fundamental thing. I mean, it's, well, the difference in how God does certain miracles. I mean, you have to ask that question.
Strikes me that you could write a whole book about this. Parallels and the lessons to be learned. And
you mean temple?
Yeah.
There's a lot there. I mean, again, listen, it's God's wisdom, so there has to be tremendous depth to it. I mean, I was looking over the Parsha yesterday, and it came across a section that, there's just so much there, you don't get a chance to focus on every single part of the Parsha every single year. So I saw a whole new area that's was just so interesting. Moses talking to God, and about God says, I'm not going to go with you, but I'll send an angel. And Moses says, no, how will we be distinguished from the other nations unless it's with you going with us? And Moses takes the tent when God says he's not going to go amongst the people because they sin. So Moses moves the tent of meeting outside the camp of Israel, and the people stood up and they saw him doing it and they felt bad. And then there's this whole thing about God telling the Jews to take their crowns off the head. And what are these crowns? Where did they get them from? And there's a whole story in the Talmud about it. That's when they were at Mount Sinai, so every person received a crown from a ministering angel. And then because they said, we will do, and then we will listen. But then when they sinned by the golden calf, twice as many angels came and took the crowns away, took the two crowns. They got one crown because they said we will do, and one crown because they said that we will listen.
But then when they sinned, and that was given to them by only one angel, one ministering angel, it says. But when they sinned, then it says two destructive angels came to each person and took those two crowns. It's a very cryptic type of a, but it's again, it's a medrash. It's not literal. It has to be understood. But again, this whole story in the Torah is right there in yesterday's section, and you go over and say, hey, you know, I never really focused on this. What's going on over here? And then as you start digging, you start seeing more distinctions. And the Jews already took off the crowns, and then God says afterwards they should take them off. And the order seems to be, you know, difficult. And then Moses goes out, moves the tent away, and then he comes back to the camp. But then it says at the end of that section, it says that Joshua didn't leave the tent. All of a sudden, we're told something about Joshua. So you can take a look. It's, I think it is 33 right at the beginning. Yeah, it's chapter 33, the first verse, 33, 1 through 11. Take a look. Maybe we'll take this up.
Which book?
It's Exodus.
33.
1 through 11. Maybe we'll take this up next week. It's an interesting little segment over here, what's going on.
I'm sorry, which verses?
Chapter 33, verse 1 through 11.
1 through 11.
Maybe take a look at that. Maybe we'll take that up this coming week.
Okay.
Yeah, but there is just so much, you know, to learn. And you read this, you know, year after year. And, then, luckily, something catches your eye and you stop and you look at something that you didn't really look at before. But it's in the Torah. It has to be very significant that God included this. All right, so let's look at this for next week. Any other questions or any comments for now?
No, I think we're good.
We're good, okay.
Thank you. This
is
excellent.
Okay, good. All right, so we'll pick up with this section. We'll do this next week. This way we'll have something to look forward to and to study and see what your questions are.
Okay.
All righty.
In that case, you have a very great week, Rabbi.
You too, Doug. You too, Cal, and Elchanan, and Joshua, and everybody else is online. Rezora, and Jehosh. Have a good week, everybody. We'll pick up next week. We'll do this section in Shemos and Exodus, chapter 33, right at the beginning, the first 11 verses. All right, good week to everybody.
All right. Thank you
very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You will.